All right, so this is Bible 231, and it is March 7th, Monday, and we're going to move on and look at some specific muscles today and learn how muscles are named, some nomenclature about muscles. So we're out of the muscle tissue chapter, and we're going to start looking at some real muscles today. And let's see, next time, no lecture. Next time there is a test, right? Your second test on bones and articulations. So bone tissue, some specific bones, and then joints or articulations. Anybody have any questions over that? All right, so we're going to start that at 10:30, and you got the whole period until when? Until 11:50 to take that test. There'll be a few more questions on there. I don't think it's quite 100 yet, but it'll just give you some more opportunities. It means you can miss a few more and still get an A or a B in the class. Eventually, we'll get to 100 questions, but we're working our way up there. Okay. Huh? On the test? Yeah, your last couple of tests will have 100, maybe a little bit more than 100 if there's an extra credit or something, but about 100. And this one, no, I think last time was 80. Yeah, so this will be a little bit more. Could be as many as 100. I don't remember exactly. Okay, but probably more than 80 because it's better. Because I don't think anybody ran out of time last time, right? So time is not that big of a problem. All right, I was going to show you some animation on contracting of a sarcomere or the sliding filament mechanism. There's some really good ones in Blackboard. I just couldn't, in the short time I had to prepare for lecture, just when I got here, I couldn't find it in Blackboard, but they're there. I'll try to find it maybe next time. I'll show it during the test or during lecture next time, okay? But you have a lot of really good animations. All right, so muscles. Most of you have had a lab in muscles already, except for the lab that's this afternoon. So some of this might be a little bit of a repeat for you guys, and others is going to be brand new information. All right, so let's talk about arrangements of muscles. As a matter of fact, let's maybe go over that hierarchical structure of how you put a muscle together. So you got a whole big muscle, like a biceps brachii. If you take the whole thing out, we say that's the muscle belly. And if you're going to break it down into its component parts, how do you put a whole big muscle together? What's the building block of a whole big muscle? Okay, it's a fascicle, right? So a whole big muscle is broken down into smaller compartments that have connective tissue around them. That's a fascicle. And then you can break a fascicle down into smaller things. What's the building block of a fascicle? It is a muscle fiber or an individual muscle cell, right? And then what can you break a muscle cell down into? What's the organelle for contraction? That's a myofibril. And then a myofibril you can break down into some smaller things. And those would be the myofilaments. And in particular, there's two kinds of myofilaments that you should be aware of. One's thick and one's thin. So what's the thick one called? Myosin. And the thin one is called actin, right? And they're all arranged so that they surround each other. And the myosin has a special little thing that can reach up and grab an actin molecule. It's called a cross bridge, right? And so those cross bridges then can pull on the actin. And then what are the endpoints of a sarcomere called? This is a review from last time. The endpoints of a sarcomere are what we call the Z lines or the Z discs. It's the very last letter of the alphabet. That's the very endpoint, last part of a sarcomere. And remember, it's the actin molecule that attaches to the Z discs. And when the actin molecules get pulled toward the very center of the sarcomere, which we call the M line, then the Z discs get pulled together and the whole sarcomere shortens. So those are some things that you should know about that microscopic structure and gross structure of a muscle. Okay, and what's a good model that you should have in your mind that explains how a sarcomere shortens? What protein actually shortens within a sarcomere? You told me there's myosin in there, there's actin in there, there's also some titin in there, which is an elastic molecule. But which ones of those molecules actually get shorter as a sarcomere shortens? And you're looking at me with suspicion, which is good because it's a trick question. Because the answer is, none of those proteins shorten. They just do what? They slide over each other. And so we call that the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. All right, one last thought before we move away from the sarcomere, and that is, what is the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle? I could start by saying, what's the structural and functional unit of life? You would say, a cell. What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone? That is the osteon, that you should probably know a little bit about for Wednesday, an osteon, what makes an osteon up. All right, and so let's go back to that structural and functional unit of contraction. What kind of tissue specializes for contraction? Yeah, it's muscle tissue. So the structural and functional unit of muscle tissue or contraction is a sarcomere, right? So eventually for the next test, you're going to have to go back and review sarcomere, make sure you know how to label it, know all the different component parts. Okay, well, we started this discussion by talking about the building block of a muscle. What's the building block of a muscle again? If you have a whole big muscle like a biceps, what's the next smallest unit that you can actually see with your naked eye? You don't need a microscope. It's a bundle of something. What's another name for a bundle? A muscle bundle is a fascicle. It's a fascicle. And a fascicle is made up of individual muscle cells. So those fascicles you can see because they're separated by connective tissues, right, like the epimysium, perimysium, right? And since you can see them, sometimes we classify muscles by the arrangements of fascicles inside of them. So this, and we can name them as well. So some muscles, like we see on the left-hand slide over here, are circular. Some muscles are circular. And remember, muscles can only shorten. They can't really push. So those muscles shorten and they can pull on something. So circular muscles, where do we have some circular muscles? Oh, let's move this back over here. Ah, does this look like a circular muscle to you? Indeed it is. Well, you could say, well, it's oval, all right, but still, it's what, basically circular, all right? When we have a skeletal muscle that is circular, and that's really what we're looking at in this chapter, are skeletal muscles, right, which means, what does a skeletal muscle mean? What connotations does that have when we say skeletal muscle? It's attached to your skeleton. Most muscles of the skeletal muscle system are attached to bones, so that means it moves bones around inside your body. But there are always exceptions to every rule, right? And so here is an exception. This circular smooth muscle is just attached to skin and of your lips, right? So this circular smooth muscle is around your mouth, and when it contracts, you close your mouth. Circular skeletal muscles usually are called orbicularis muscles. And then they're also named by the location that they're in. So this is around your mouth. We call that the orbicularis oris muscle. So can you see the different fascicles in here or muscle bundles? Indeed I can. And it's a nice circular arrangement. That's the orbicularis oris. We're going to look at a couple of other orbicularis muscles. All right, so not only can we have fascicles arranged in a circle, but we can also have them, if we look on the slide on the left over here, long fibers that are all arranged in a nice parallel fashion. All right, so some that are parallel, a good example would be the sartorius muscle. Here is the sartorius that's in our thigh. All of these fascicles you can see are what, just nice and collinear. They're all arranged parallel to each other. So sartorius would be a really good example of that. But there are many other good types. For instance, some are strap-like, okay, like this sartorius right here, but there's also another one that's very strap-like, and that's the sternocleidomastoid. And when we look at that name, that's pretty intimidating, all right, until we really get to take a look at it. Let me show you where the sternocleidomastoid is. Sternocleidomastoid, strap-like muscles. Sorry, got to bring this back up. All right, here's the sternocleidomastoid, and there are actually two straps. But what about the fascicle arrangement right here? They are still nice and parallel with each other. And these muscles don't get any thicker or thinner as we move from one end to the other. So we call it just a strap, kind of looks like a belt. All right, another kind that's parallel, but the ends are pointed. A good example of that would be the biceps brachii. And when it looks like that, we call it a fusiform muscle, or it has a fusiform shape. So where is a muscle that has a fusiform shape? Okay, right here is the biceps. So notice that both ends of the muscle kind of pinch together. It's like you're pinching both ends. And fusiform just means that it has the shape maybe of like a whale or a porpoise. And how is the nose on a porpoise? Is it as wide in diameter as the body of a porpoise? No, it's very sleek, right? So it can cut through water. All right, so fusiform just means that it has a shape kind of like a fish, where the head of the fish is narrow and the tail of the fish is kind of narrow again, but the body of the fish is really broad. So a good example of a fusiform parallel type muscle is the biceps brachii. All right, another kind of muscle is what we call convergent. All right, what does that word convergent mean? To converge on something. How about a freeway? Can you tell me an example of a freeway system that is convergent? It's when what? Two freeways actually come together, and there's usually a big log jam there, right? When two freeways join together. Like what? The 22 and the 405 when they join together. It's always a big mess right there. All right, so again, what are you looking at? We're going to be looking at the fascicle arrangement. All right, where you have a very broad arrangement, kind of looks like a fan of fascicles out over here, but they all come together, they converge on this point right here. So this is a convergent fascicle arrangement. A good example would be a pectoralis major. Okay, and let's see what else we got. Pennate. What the heck does pennate mean? And what is a pennant? Has anybody ever flown a pennant? A pennant is the same thing as a flag. And what do you fly a flag off of? A flagpole, right? So it's all attached to like a flagpole. So here is an example of, right, a unipennant kind of arrangement. Look at all the fascicles. They're kind of parallel, right? But they don't all attach at the same place. Here's a connection that is dense, regular connective tissue that's eventually going to connect to a bone someplace. So what do we call a muscle-to-bone connection? And it's diagrammed right here, illustrated as a white material. Muscle to bone is a tendon. Okay, so there is some central tendon, and the fascicles attach to that tendon, and when the muscles pull on this tendon, then they pull on the bone that it's attached to. But can you tell this is a much different kind of arrangement? It's not really parallel, it's not convergent. We call this a pennate arrangement, and since there's one tendon right here, we call that unipennant. A good example would be the extensor digitorum longus in somebody's thumb, for instance. Right? Or flexor pollicis longus. That would be in somebody's big toe. Would look very much like this. Bipennate means that we have muscles on either side of this common tendon. So it's like flying two flags off of the flagpole right here. So let's see if I can find a nice bipennate right here. All right, so here is like the flagpole, here is that central tendon, and we have muscle on either side of it, right, rectus femoris, and we can even have something even more complicated, like a multipennate. Multipennate, a good example would be a deltoid muscle. Okay, so here is like one flagpole, and we see muscle fascicles attaching to either side, but here is another common tendon right here, and then there's even a third one over here, right? So this is what we call multipennate, and when we put all of these different fascicles together, right, it forms kind of like a triangle, and that's where we get this name, the deltoid muscle, because a deltoid is just a triangle, right? A triangle is a deltoid in what language? Anybody know? Greek, right? So that's a delta. Sometimes we call that a delta. That's the letter D. In Greek, I don't speak Greek, so I don't know if there's a good translation between the letter D and the delta, but I think it's pretty close. All right, so we can name muscles by their fascicle arrangement. All right, so those are important things to know about. Let's see, muscle interactions. Some muscles work together to perform the same kind of motion. All right, and really good examples of that would be the biceps brachii and the brachialis muscle. So let's see if I can find where these guys are at. Biceps and brachialis. That's not bad, but maybe I want to show you even a better illustration. So let's go to a zoomed in region right right here. Okay, so what are we looking at? We see somebody's neck. This is an anterior view. Here's their shoulder. There's the deltoid. Here's pectoralis major. Then here's the biceps brachii. All right, so what body compartment is the biceps brachii in? And I'm pointing right to it. It's in the arm, but what part of the arm? Is it anterior or posterior? All right, so that's going to be really important to know. All right, so anterior arm, that's the biceps brachii, and then right below it, right in this region right here, as a matter of fact, the biceps is completely covering up, is the brachialis muscle. And the brachialis is actually even bigger than the biceps, and it's just deep to the biceps brachii, but nonetheless, it's still in the anterior arm. It's not so deep that it's in the posterior arm. All right, so you have the biceps brachii in the anterior arm and the brachialis in the anterior arm. Since they're in the same body compartment, they have exactly the same motion. So when the biceps contracts, what happens to my forearm? It flexes, or you could say the elbow flexes, right? So the biceps flexes at the elbow or flexes the forearm. And since the brachialis is in the same body compartment, when it contracts, it causes flexion of the forearm or flexion at the elbow. You could say flexion at the joint that it's moving or the bones that actually move or the body compartment, either way. So since these two muscles, the biceps brachii and brachialis, are in the same body compartment, they perform the same motion, they're forearm flexors, right? And where's your forearm? It's between your elbow and your wrist, right? So that's what moves, right? We say they are synergist muscles. So a synergist muscle is two muscles or any number of groups of muscles that perform the same kind of motion, right? And a good take-home message is, if they perform the same motion, what body compartment do they have to be in? They have to be in the same body compartment, right? So if you have synergist muscles, if you have one muscle in your anterior thigh, where would you find a synergist muscle to a muscle in your anterior thigh? It's going to be in the anterior thigh as well, right? Or if you have a synergist muscle in your posterior thigh, where would you look for another synergist muscle that performs the same motion? The posterior thigh, okay? So synergist muscles are in the same body compartment. Now, even though you might have a number of muscles that perform the same motion, like, for instance, flexion of the forearm, like we talked about the biceps brachii and brachialis, one is usually doing more work than the other. And that muscle we call the prime mover. And this is kind of misunderstood a little bit, maybe even in your anatomy book. The prime mover for forearm flexion, surprisingly, is not the biceps brachii, but it's actually the brachialis muscle. The brachialis, when we look at it in lab, is bigger and stronger, and because of the attachment points, you'll see that that's the one that's actually doing most of the work when what? You start to do curls or lift weights like that. The biceps brachii certainly does get a workout, but it's the brachialis that does most of the work, so we call it the what? The prime mover. Okay. All right. Let's think about antagonist muscles. And this is probably the most important concept in anatomy, for sure, in a physiology class. And that is the concept of antagonism. And when you think of that term, antagonism, does it have a good connotation or a bad connotation to you? Like, you want to be around friends that are antagonistic to you all the time? Saying, oh, wow, where did you get those pair of pants? Didn't you throw those shoes away last year? You know, that kind of stuff. Are they fun to be around? It has a really negative connotation, right? So, but in anatomy and physiology, it's very important, okay? Antagonism is good. It's fantastic, okay? Because it provides for precise control and balance. And I think we talked about this last time, but we just have to review it again, okay? So let's just say that you had to talk to this person with a blue uniform over the weekend, like Friday night, with the badge and the sidearm. Okay, and they pulled you over, you were driving your car, and that person said, with your eyes closed, I want you to take your finger and put it on the tip of your nose like that. All right, so he wanted to see you had precise control and balance of your fingertip. Meaning what? That you are not intoxicated. So what provides for that nice precise control and balance? It is antagonism, right? It's the balance between the biceps brachii, which is in your anterior arm that causes what? Flexion, but you can't just have that muscle working, because if that's the only muscle that's working, where is that finger going to end up? Well, it could be end up in your mouth or your nose or inside your eye or maybe in the officer's nose, right? Okay, so in order to balance that out, what do you need? You need a muscle in the opposite body compartment, and that's what we call the triceps brachii. So the triceps and biceps brachii are in opposite body compartments. They perform opposite motions, and as a result, when they work together, even though they work in opposition, you have precise control of your fingertip. All right, so if the biceps causes flexion of the forearm, what does the triceps do? It performs the opposite motion, which is extension of the forearm. These signals are blended together to give you precise control and balance, and so these are antagonist muscles, but is that important? Is that a good thing? Oh, absolutely, right? If you don't want to end up in the hoozy, that's a wonderful thing. So in your automobile, you have antagonistic mechanisms, but to have precise control and balance of your automobile, what are the two mechanisms that you have that you would never think of driving a car without them? They are the gas and the brake pedal, right? So antagonism is a really beautiful thing, right? Because if you only have the gas pedal tonight when you're driving home from work and you got home, what would you do when you got home? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop, right? So that is no fun. I certainly agree. All right, so that's the importance of antagonism. Other kinds of muscles are what we call fixators. They don't really move a bone. They don't move a part of your body, but they hold on to a bone so that it doesn't move, so that other muscles that are attached to that bone have something to grab onto so that they can do their job properly. There are a number of muscles around the scapula that's in your back that hold it in position so that other muscles, like the biceps and triceps, can pull on the scapula and make other parts of your body move in just the right way. All right, so fixators are synergist muscles which work to hold the bone firmly in place, right? So they're more like postural muscles. They enable a stable base for motion in a different body region. Okay, so when you move your arm around, your scapula has to be fixed in position. Therefore, we call those fixator muscles. Like rhomboids, for instance, would be good examples of that. All right, so now here is something pretty important. Nomenclature of muscles. You're going to have to know the names of muscles and origins and insertions and actions. But this list right here is going to make learning most of the muscles pretty easy so you don't have to memorize them. All right, so if you know something about nomenclature, it really simplifies your life a lot. Sometimes we name a muscle by the location in the body, right? For instance, the brachialis. Where would you look for the brachialis? Would you look at it on the top of your head? How about in your foot? Where would you look? In the brachium or in your arm someplace, right? And what do we call that between your shoulder and your elbow? That's your arm, right? So that's where you would look for it. Or intercostals. Remember, a costal is a rib, so these are muscles between. Inter means between the ribs, right? So that's a pretty good idea. Let me see if I have some pictures of these things. Maybe not too many pictures of these different locations. No, but that's okay, I can describe. Sometimes we talk about a muscle or name a muscle by its shape. So for instance, the deltoid muscle on the superior part of your shoulder right there, what shape does it have? It looks like a triangle or the Greek letter delta, right? Or that's a good example. Sometimes you might have a number of muscles that are synergists to each other. And if there's two, one might be a lot longer than the other. Or you might have three. One is really long, one is really short, and one that's kind of intermediate in size. And so, for instance, we'll name it gluteus maximus. Which one is that? That's the big one of that group. And then you've got the gluteus minimus. That is the smallest one in the group. And then you got gluteus medius, which is right in the middle size, right? All right, so sometimes you might have also, if it's a long muscle, like an extensor longus or an extensor brevis. The brevis would be the short one of that group. The longus would be the longer one. Okay, we also have by the direction of fascicles. A rectus is a muscle where all the fascicles are parallel to each other. Rectus just means straight. A good example would be the rectus abdominis. And now, even though maybe you have never heard of this one, you could tell me where you would find it. Where would you find the rectus abdominis? in surrounding your abdominal cavity in your anterior body compartment. And it's going to be one that just goes straight up and down, okay, rectus abdominis. External oblique is going to be in the abdominal compartment, but it's going to be oblique, meaning what? At an angle to the rectus abdominis. So it's going to be angulated a little bit. All right, here's a really good one. We also name muscles by the location of attachments. All right, so a muscle generally has two ends to it, and it's attached to two different bones. And what are the two ends of a muscle called? I think we talked about it already. Origin and insertion. And it's good to have a functional understanding of origin and insertion. All right, the origin is attached to a bone that undergoes very little motion. It's the most stable end of a muscle, right? And the insertion is the part of the muscle that is attached to a bone that undergoes a lot of motion. So insertion is the more movable end, origin is the least movable end. So sometimes we name a muscle literally by its origin and insertion, and the nomenclature we use is that we say the origin goes at the beginning part of the word and insertion is at the end of the word. Okay, so some examples would be like this big intimidating one right here, sternocleidomastoid. Well, once you understand how we named it, it's going to be actually fun. It's going to be really easy, and it's going to be a really good lesson. Sternocleidomastoid. We see it on this diagram right here. I showed it to you already as being strap-like muscles with parallel fascicle arrangements. And here it is. It has two attachments that are inferior, one on the sternum, right? And so that's the first part of the word. So what is that? Is that the origin or insertion? That's an origin, and here is a second origin. It's on the, what bone is this right here? Clavicle, but that's in the name as clido. So sternoclido are both the origins, and then the insertion, what do you know about mastoid? What kind of, how would you tell somebody something about mastoid? It's a process on the temporal bone behind your earlobe right here, and we can see it. Here's the mastoid process. That's the insertion because it's the last part of the word. And in anatomy, if we take different words and put them together, what do we have to do with those two different words? We put an O between them, right? Then it's very legal to do that and proper, and people know exactly what you're talking about. So the sternocleidomastoid has got two origins, one on the clavicle, one on the sternum. The insertion is the mastoid process. And when that muscle contracts, remember, muscles can't push. They can only contract or shorten. You have the sternocleidomastoids that are bilateral to each other on either side of your neck, and when it contracts, it's going to, what moves? Does your sternum move or does your mastoid process move? Yeah, the mastoid process gets pulled down to the sternum and the clavicle, just like that. All right. What do we call that motion? That is flexion. Yeah, flexion of the neck or cervical spine or vertebral column, depending on how precise you want it to be. Okay, but since it's bilateral, that causes flexion, but you can contract one and not the other unilaterally. If you only contract one, what does that do? It causes not only flexion, thanks so much, it also causes what? A rotation, right? If I contract the other one, it causes a rotation the other way. All right, so these are important muscles. So sometimes we'll name a muscle by origin and insertion. That's really handy because if you remember your bones, then you know what body compartment it's in. You're going to know the action of that muscle, okay? And since it's in the anterior neck, where would you start to look for muscles that perform the opposite motion? So if sternocleidomastoid is in the anterior neck causing flexion, where are you going to find muscles that are antagonistic to it? The posterior neck, all right, for extension of the cervical spine. And is that important? Is it important to have a stable neck? Oh, absolutely. And the muscle that does that, you're going to see in lab, that's the splenius capitis. And the insertion of the splenius capitis is exactly the same point as the sternocleidomastoid, and it is the mastoid process, but the origin is going to be in the back, the spinous and transverse processes of some upper thoracic vertebrae. Okay, so when you look at antagonism, just think of an opposite body compartment. All right, so we talked about a number of different things with naming muscles by origin and insertion. And so on the test, that's so important, I'm going to give you a name of a muscle that you have not heard before. But you're going to know the bone parts or parts of the body that it attaches to, and I'll ask you what's the origin or the insertion. But that's going to be easy because where's the answer? The answer is part of the question. You just look at the word, right? So what is the origin going to be? It's the first part of the word, and where's the insertion? The second part of the word. All right, so you now learn the names of thousands of muscles, right? As long as you understand what? Nomenclature, right? Okay. All right, so how else can we name muscles? This is pretty nice. We can name them by the number of origins. Like the biceps brachii. Guess how many origins it has? It's got two. All right, so I think I showed you a picture of the biceps brachii already. Oh, don't see it very well right there. Okay. Okay, bicep. Here's the biceps brachii. One origin is a coracoid process. The other origin is the supraglenoid tubercle. Right? Remember the glenoid fossa, glenoid cavity on the scapula? It's got two origins. And the long head actually goes through, what do you call this, between the tubercles on the humerus? There's a depression right there. Anybody remember what that depression is called? The intertubercular groove or sulcus. Sulcus and groove have the same name. All right, so this for sure is a nice biceps because it has two origins. And then the insertion goes across the elbow, and there's actually a couple insertions as well on the radius and on some fascia right above the ulna. So when the biceps brachii contracts, it moves what? The radius and ulna up toward the scapula, right? So that's what we call flexion of the forearm, okay? We also see that it works across the shoulder. So biceps brachii. How many origins does the triceps brachii have? You never learned that, but you could probably now tell me. It has three. What about the quadriceps femoris? In that name, you know how many origins it has, which is four, and where would you find it? Where is the femoral region? That's in your thigh. Okay, so that's the quadriceps femoris. And so it's a big, strong muscle that has four different groups, and they all attached to a common insertion, namely the patella, which is part of the knee, which you have to know for the next practicum. And probably on Wednesday, is the knee an exam figure? I believe it is. Okay, so when I say patella, that shouldn't be like really strange for you. Okay, we can also name muscles by their actions, which is handy. All right, so sometimes it will be a flexor muscle, which does what? Show me flexion. Show me flexion of something on your hand. Like when you grab something, that's flexion. Okay, there are a number of muscles in your forearm that flex the digits. So all of those are going to be, what? Flexor muscles, right? And sometimes we name a muscle by what they move. If they move your fingers, what kind of muscle is it going to be? And if it's the anterior forearm, all of those are going to be flexor. What are your fingers called? Digits. Okay, the bones are phalanges, but those actual appendages right here are digits. So all the muscles in your anterior forearm are going to be flexor digitorum muscles. And some are going to be long. If it's a long one, you're going to say flexor digitorum what? Longus. If it's a little dinky one, it's going to be a flexor digitorum brevis, right, for instance. Okay. All right, and so if these are all flexors in your anterior forearm, what would you name those same muscles in your posterior forearm? These are going to be extensor muscles, right? So again, we name muscles by the action. So these would all be extensor digitorum. Some are long, so extensor digitorum longus, extensor digitorum brevis. All right, so it's really nice to know. Adductor muscles, all right, and abductors. There are some muscles in your medial thigh, right, that bring your legs together, and those are really strong. So what do you call that when you bring your legs together like that? What's that motion? That's adduction, right? When you spread your legs apart, that's abduction. And the abductors are not very strong, but the adductors are really strong. Why do you think the adductors have to be really strong? Because what will happen to you if you're walking or standing and all of a sudden you abduct because your adductors are too weak? Well, you're going to fall on your butt, right? Your legs are just going to spread apart and you're going to fall. Okay, so adductors in your legs have to be strong to hold you up. All right, so these are all really cool ways that we can name muscles so you don't have to just memorize every single one. So, for instance, let's try a muscle that has actually four words that make up its name. We haven't put an O between them. We could, but we just keep it four different words. And now you should tell me something about this muscle. Extensor, okay, carpi, radialis longus. Okay, so there's going to be a group of these. Of the group, what is this one? It's the long one. Okay. And carpi, what's it going to work on?
Carpals.
Where do you have your carpals? In your what? In your what? That's in your wrist. Okay, carpals are in your wrist. All right, and extension is what? Is it like that or like that? Okay, extension is, okay, when you bend your palms backwards like that when you're in anatomic position, that's extensor. All right, so extensor, carpi, radialis longus. So what side of the forearm is it going to be? Is it going to be over here, number one, or over here, number two? It's going to be along the radius, which is what? The lateral bone in your forearm. So it's going to be an extensor. So what are these in this anterior forearm? These are all flexors. So it's going to be in the posterior forearm over here, aligned along the radius, which is going to extend. It's going to insert into the wrist muscle. So it's for extension of the wrist. So that's how we name muscles. It seems complicated, but once you look at it, I think it will make really good sense for you. Okay, who's got a question about that? Any questions about that? No, you're going to have to just look at muscles. All right, so when it comes to naming muscles, this next chart right here, not in your book, I can't get the whole thing nicely shown. Oh, yeah, here we go. Okay, muscle growth anatomy, the actions. And you should probably memorize this list and practice this. So those of you that are kinesthetic learners, that actually learn something by motion, right? This is going to be really easy for you. Other people that learn in other different ways, it might be a little bit more difficult. Okay, but let's look at this list. The muscles in the anterior neck, you might have more than one. What are all of these going to do? When we talked about a muscle in the anterior neck already, which one was that? The sternocleidomastoid muscle, anterior neck. What did it do? Remember, a muscle can only pull. It's going to cause flexion, okay, of your cervical spine, right, or head flexion. All right, and what about the opposite body compartment? It's going to cause extension. All right, so now we've looked at what? Antagonist muscles and opposite body compartments. So antagonistic muscles are always going to be in opposite body compartments. If you have two muscles in the same body compartment, what would we use to talk about those muscles? Can they be antagonistic? No, they're going to be what? Synergistic muscles if they're in the same body compartment. So, anterior trunk, right? Like the rectus abdominis, anterior trunk. When it contracts, right, that flexes the vertebral column. Where would you look for muscles that extend the vertebral column? In your back, right? Your posterior trunk. Back muscles for extension. Right, so for extension of the vertebral column. Muscles that move the forearm. Okay, muscles that move the forearm are going to not be in the forearm, they're going to be in the arm. Right? And when this motion is what? This is flexion at the elbow or flexion of the forearm. And during the test, if you can't remember what body compartment is, go ahead and flex the arm and feel what muscle contracts. And at least on me, I can tell. It's this anterior muscle right here. Okay? Sort of kidding, but I can still feel it. All right, so this would be what? Anterior arm causing flexion of the forearm. And where would you find muscles that cause extension of the forearm? The posterior arm. All right, so are you kind of getting the picture there a little bit? Okay, muscles that flex and extend the wrist or flex and extend the digits are going to be in your forearm. So the forearm compartment right here are all flexors, either of the digits. We call those digitorum muscles. If it flexes the wrist, those are carpi muscles, and then depending on what side it is, if they're either ulnar or radial muscles. All right, so that's for flexion. Where would you find muscles for extension of the wrist and digits? In the posterior forearm, and those would be extensor carpi radialis, extensor carpi ulnaris, or extensor digitorum muscles for the fingers. All right, and then the hip. I don't have the hip right here. Okay, but here's the hip. This is kind of this is an easy motion to know. All right, so at the hip, what is this? So my knee is going to bend, but don't look at my leg. Look at my thigh, because here's my hip. So what's that motion? That's flexion, and then this is extension, and then we got hyperextension. So there's a muscle that is pretty deep, but it's still anterior. It goes across the hip that causes flexion. It's called the iliopsoas muscle. That causes hip flexion. That's anterior. Now, where would you find one that extends the hip? Posterior. What do you got posterior? Gluteus maximus, right? That's extension. All right, so flexion, extension, opposite body compartments. All right, the leg. Where's your leg? Leg. Muscles of the leg. Okay, here's your leg between your knee and your ankle. All right, it's not going to move your leg, but it's going to move across your ankle. So the motions are what? Lifting your toes up off the ground. That is called dorsiflexion, pointing your toes into the ground. That is plantar flexion. So the muscles that lift your toes up off the ground, okay, are in your anterior leg right here. So lift your toes, dorsiflex, and you can see that big tibialis anterior muscle contracting. If you plantar flex like that, you can feel the gastrocnemius contracting. Opposite motions, the muscles are in what? Opposite body compartments. Okay. So this is just a nice clue about muscle actions. Okay, but we do want to know in lab, for instance, right, you're going to have a mannequin and there'll be an arrow pointing to this muscle right here, and you do have to know muscles, their name by location. All right, so here's pectoralis major. So I'll show you some muscles and talk about them in class, but I can't go over every single muscle that you have in lab because we do that in lab. All right, but here's some examples that are important for you to know. All right, muscles of the head. All right, occipital frontalis. All right, so what do you know when you hear that word, occipital frontalis? Look, I see a nice O in there. That's a clue for something. What have we done? We've taken two body regions and put them together. All right, and when we do that, what do we know? The first part is the origin. The second part is the insertion. So occipital frontalis. All right, let me get that muscle up here for you, occipital frontalis. All right, so where's the occipital bone? Is it in your foot? No, that's good. You're on the right track for Wednesday. The occipital bone is way back in your skull, all right, and that's the origin. And the insertion, right, is near the frontal bone. Now, most muscles have these two attachment points on bone. So when the muscle contracts, the bones get pulled closer together. But there are some exceptions to that rule. Sometimes a muscle inserts not into a bone, but into some soft tissue, like skin. Right? And so if the insertion is skin and the muscle contracts, that part, that skin in your body is going to move, not a bone. Right? All right. And that makes perfect sense because what are the joints between the occipital bone and the frontal bone over here? What are those joints? There's sutures, and what can you tell me about the function of sutures? They're immovable. That's right, they're immovable joints. And what do we call an immovable joint? It's a, yeah, it's SAD, it's what? It's the S in SAD, it's what, the syndesmosis. All right, so when this muscle contracts, obviously the frontal bone and occipital bone don't move, all right, but the skin above the eyebrows move. All right, so if this is the end that's producing motion right here, it is what? The second part of the word frontalis, right? And what about the occipital bone? When the occipital frontalis contracts, what about the occipital bone? Do that. Just contract those muscles. Is your occipital bone moving? No, your head isn't moving. It's just your eyebrows that are moving, right? So this is the origin, and then here is the insertion. Okay. Now, let's talk about why is it important for a muscle to have an origin? Does anybody have an idea why is it important for a muscle to have an origin? Okay. Well, let's just say I wanted to move this little table right here. All right, and it's moving around. All right, so I have a muscle that's attached to the floor, and let's simplify it. I have a muscle attached to the floor, and another muscle that's attached to the table. And I want to move the table. All right, so now I'm moving it back and forth. But now, let's just say I'm going to contract that muscle, but now my feet are going to slip from underneath me. Will I be able to move the table if my feet are slipping? So if I pull on this and I slip, does the table move? You know, it really doesn't. Or if your car is stuck in the snow or mud or something, and you want to pull your car out of the mud, so your feet are on the ground and you pull on your car and your feet slip out from underneath you, is your car going to move? No. So an origin is necessary to form an anchor point for a muscle so that the other end of the muscle can do its job, right? So an origin is very important to be stable. That's why we have other muscles that we call fixators that fix bones in certain positions, right? So this muscle right here, occipital frontalis, has to have a stable origin in order to raise the eyebrows. If the occipital bone moved at the same time, then the eyebrows wouldn't elevate very much, right? So origins are important. All right, so with this example right here, occipital frontalis also illustrates that muscles can have different names too, can have more than one name. And the name for occipital frontalis, or another name, is the epicranius. Epi means what? Above, like epidermis is a layer above the dermis. So this is the muscle above the cranium, right? And if we call it the epicranius, then we see that there are two different muscle bellies. There's one that's called the occipitalis, or occipital belly, and then here would be the frontalis, or frontal belly. So depending on who you talk to, some people consider it one muscle or two muscles that form one muscle called the epicranius, and it's interconnected by a broad, flat, tendinous sheath that's on the top of your head. So you don't really have any muscles right smack on the top of your cranium. It's just a tendon that connects the frontalis with the occipitalis right here. And a broad, flat, tendinous sheath in anatomy is called an aponeurotia, or in this particular case, it's called the aponeurotica. Okay, so we're going to find different aponeuroses in different parts of your body. Okay, so by nomenclature, origin and insertion. All right, sternocleidomastoid, we talked about already. Again, it's named by what? The origin and then the insertion right here. And if you know origin and insertion, which is part of the name, then you know what? The motion that it's produced. Now, in anatomy, I feel a little bit bad about this, but we're not asking you to know the innervation, the name of the nerves that go to each of these muscles. But maybe one or two are really, really important that we'll learn about a little bit later. All right, so it's just the name, origin, insertion, and then the motion is what you have to know about these muscles. Okay, trunk muscles, different body regions. So trunk muscle, maybe let's look right here. So here are some trunk muscles. Here's a muscle that goes straight up and down, all right, superior, inferiorly. One end is attached to the xiphoid process. The other end is attached to, what bone is this right here? Yeah, that's the pubic bone. And the joint between the pubic bones is the pubic symphysis, but this is really the pubis, and the ischium, you know, is back over here. And then here's the ilium that make up os coxae. All right, so that's the rectus abdominis. And when it contracts, what bone moves? Does the pubic bone move, or does the sternum move when that muscle contracts? Yeah, the sternum, the xiphoid process, moves down toward the pubic bone. What do you call that motion when your vertebral column does this? That's flexion, yeah. So these anterior trunk muscles cause flexion of the vertebral column. And here is the insertion. No, here's the origin, pubic bone, and here is the insertion. Is that what I have on my slide? Pubic bone, xiphoid process of sternum, vertebral column flexion. Good. All right, well, let's depart from this word slide a little bit and think about, now, what's really important about stabilizing your vertebral column? Not only do you have to have muscles that contract, that flex, you have to have muscles that do what? That extend the vertebral column. Working together, they'll protect your vertebral column. Where would you look to find muscles that extend your vertebral column? At least your thoracic and lumbar region. They're going to be in your posterior trunk. What do you call your posterior trunk? That's just your back, okay? Okay, that's your back. So antagonistic muscles to the rectus abdominis right here will be in your back. And you've got hundreds or thousands of muscles back there, but we're going to simplify it. You're going to have to know one, and we're going to call those the erector spinae muscles when we get to it. Erector spinae for extending the vertebral column. So erector spinae work in opposition to what muscle? Erector spinae in the back work in opposition to the rectus abdominis, which is in your anterior trunk. Okay. All right, so what else do we have to know? Let's look at some different body compartments. Upper limbs. All right, upper limbs. As a matter of fact, let's look at the arm. Biceps brachii. Right here. Oh, you have a pretty good model of biceps brachii. Where is that at? Right here. Okay, so there's the biceps brachii. And from the name, you know how many origins does it have? It's got two. Right, so here are the two origins. The long head is to the supraglenoid tubercle. That's that little rough spot right above the glenoid cavity. And then the coracoid process for the short head. And the insertion, because when that biceps contracts, the humerus really doesn't move very much. Okay, it can. I'll tell you about that in a second. But the body region that moves the most is the forearm. So here is the insertion. All right, so for the biceps, it's the radial tuberosity right here. And a little bit of some fascia around the ulna, and that causes forearm flexion. Where would you look to find an antagonist muscle to the biceps brachii? Posterior arm, and that's just the triceps brachii. Oh, it's the next one right here. Triceps brachii. Okay, in the posterior arm, it's got three origins. One origin is the infraglenoid tubercle, which is right here. It's kind of interesting, but it's right on the opposite side compared to the long head of the biceps brachii. So there's some nice symmetry there. Okay, let me see if I can find... this is as good as we have. All right, so here is the long head going up to the infraglenoid tubercle. Then here is the medial head and the long head, but they kind of superimpose so that you can't see them very much. Okay, but one is on the proximal posterior shaft of the humerus, right, which is what, way up over here, and the other is the distal posterior shaft, so it's down here a little bit closer to the distal epiphysis, right, so there are actually three different origins. Now the insertion is this place on the ulna, which is what, the olecranon process, and since this triceps is a big, strong muscle, what can you tell me about that olecranon process? Is it just a little dinky piece of bone? It's what? It's big and massive, right? It has changed. It now can accommodate that stress when the triceps contracts, and it pulls on the ulna, extending your forearm. All right, so the action would be forearm extension. Okay, lower limbs. Got one more specific example. Lower limbs, gastrocnemius. All right, so we're looking, gastrocnemius is in the posterior, between your knee and your leg. What do you call that, between your knee and your leg? I mean, between your knee and your ankle, sorry. I was thinking of a drink I wanted to take. Between your knee and your ankle is what? Is your leg, right? That's your leg. What's between your hip and your knee? That's not your leg, that's your thigh. All right, so we're in the posterior leg. All right, and anything in the posterior leg, let's look and see where that is. Okay, so here's posterior leg. The origins are going to be on the right above the condyles of the femur, both the medial and lateral condyles of the femur, going across the knee. So the gastrocnemius has two origins. All right, but there's a common insertion. They fuse together, and it inserts into the calcaneus. So when the gastrocnemius contracts, it pulls the calcaneus superiorly. So which way do your toes move? If the calcaneus is elevated, which way do your toes move? Yeah, they're down. What do we call that motion? I don't really want to call it depression, an elevation, but when the toes point into the ground, that's called plantar flexion. Okay. So the gastrocnemius, posterior leg, is an important plantar flexors. So you notice that in athletes that run all the time, or cyclists that are pushing their pedals down, you can imagine what their gastrocnemius is like. It's hypertrophied, it's big and well-defined, right? Because they are, what, pushing their toes into the ground all the time, pulling on the calcaneus via the calcaneal tendon. The calcaneal tendon has, like a number of other structures, two names. It can also be called the Achilles tendon. All right, from, it's named after Achilles from Greek mythology. Okay, I don't think it's a true story. Okay, so if the gastrocnemius is a plantar flexor, where would you look to find a dorsiflexor? Your anterior leg, all right? And one that is antagonistic to it, in your anterior leg right here, this is a tibialis anterior, and it's right along what bone? The tibia, and it's what? In your anterior leg, tibialis anterior. So there should be some rhyme or reason for you to understand all of these different motions. All right, so I just gave you a few examples in how to analyze the names of muscles, their location and their actions, and how that corresponds to their origin and insertion. And online you have some really good activities to help you learn some of these things. So let's look in weekly assignments. All right, and let's look in a muscle chapter, like muscles of the body right here. So there are some static drag and drop exercises that you can just practice labeling muscles, right, like axial muscles of the appendages, okay, for chewing, for instance. Muscles of facial expression, let's just see if there's anything in here. Oh, it's still there, good. All right, so what do we call a circular muscle? Orbicularis, okay, and the orbicularis around the eyes is the oculi. So do you see an orbicularis oculi someplace? Ah, here, how about that? Now, where is it labeled? Orbicularis oculi, how about that? Oh, yeah, really good. Okay, so orbicularis oris, where's that? Oh, that's probably right here, right? That looks like orbicularis oris. Now, you don't have to know all of these, just the ones that are in your lab list, okay, your lab manual. So you can practice dragging and dropping. Now for actually muscle actions, there are a number of really good websites that do that. How about, do I have any of that facial expression? All right, so this is Get Body Smart, but this should be a direct link to that location. It didn't go. Ah, it went over here. Put it in a new tab. So remember, you could right click and you can put it in a new window or a new tab, however you like. Maybe a new window would be a good thing to do. All right, but here it got put in a new tab. And so here are a bunch of muscles. Some of these you have to know. And here's the frontalis muscle, which is part of what? The occipital frontalis, but this is just an anterior view. So you can click on that. And you can use a slider to reflect or remove a bunch of muscles right here. So this is a nice virtual dissection program. You don't have to have an actual cadaver right in front of you, right? And so it says the origin. If you click on that, it shows the origin, right? And insertion, it originates in the aponeurotica, and the insertion is the skin above around the eyebrows. And if you want to see the action, click on this link right here, and you can see what? Ooh, elevation of the eyebrows. Or you can move this slider over to watch what the action is, right? So you can actually practices, and it's all the same action, wrinkling of the forehead and raising of the eyebrows, right? Important muscle for facial expression. Let's go back and maybe look at some other muscles. How about muscles that work on the arm? Okay, and let's look at the pectoralis major. We got one? Good, here's pectoralis major. All right, now this is kind of funny. What's the definition for flexion, the typical definition for flexion? It decreases an angle between two bones. So right now, what's the angle between bones of my forearm and my arm? It's 180 degrees, right? It's just straight. If I decrease it, now it's what? 90. Right now it's 45, so that's what we call flexion. Extension is what? Making the angle bigger. 45, 90, 180 degrees, that's extension. Okay. The motion of the shoulder, I don't see that definition very well. All right, so, but remember, you can abduct and adduct at the shoulder. All right, but now what is this motion right here? It's either going to be flexion or extension, but what angle is increasing or decreasing? Maybe it's this angle here. It's hard for me to picture. All right, so what I like to do is show you an analogy between the shoulder and the hip. So right now, what's the angle between my trunk and my thigh right here? It's what? Straight, 180 degrees. What is the angle now? 90. So what is that motion? When I bring my knee up like that, that is what? That's flexion, and this is extension when I put my foot back on the ground, and then when if I put my foot behind me at the hip, what's that? Hyperextension, all right? So that's pretty easy to see. 90, from going from 180 to 90, that's flexion. All right, so use that same key, using your hip to understand your shoulder. So if you flex at the hip, what's this motion at the shoulder? That's flexion. And if you go like that with your hip, that is extension. What is this at the shoulder? That is extension as well. All right, so flexion, extension, and what is that? Hyperextension, right? So you can hyperextend the shoulder as well. All right, so that's the best way to do it, and you're going to have to reinforce that. So let's look at the pectoralis, right? So let's get rid of some of these muscles, like the deltoid just went away. So this is good for just practicing the name by location of muscles. All right, so we want to look at the pectoralis. We're going to move all of these out of the way. So now we're left with the pectoralis major, right? And here we can see the origin, the head of the clavicle, right, medial half of this and of the sternum right here. And the insertion is, right, this lateral lip right here of the intertubercular groove. So right in here, so it's kind of the proximal head of the humerus. That's why we wanted to know all those different things of the bones, because it's going to be really helpful for muscles. But now what the heck is the action? It flexes the arm. What's flexion of the arm? Show me flexion of the arm. What is that? Okay, so don't forget, this is forearm, here's your arm, that's flexion, what's this? Extension. So the pectoralis major, one of the motions is flexion, and should we be able to see that in our little muscle man right here? Flex his arm at shoulder. Ah, look at that. Do you see the flexion? All right, so flexion, like that, and then what's the opposite motion? That's extension. All right, so if the pectoralis major causes flexion, can the pectoralis major cause extension? No, because a muscle can never push. It can only pull. Uh-oh, I just lost something. Let's look at the color. What color is it? Okay, that means it's not good anymore. Okay, so, all right, so if this is flexion by the pectoralis major, all right, the pectoralis major cannot cause extension, where would you look to find muscles that are going to extend the arm? In your back, namely the big, powerful muscle in your back that's for extension, is called latissimus dorsi. Okay, so flexion. So let's go back once and let's just see, do we have something like latissimus dorsi? Oh, here we go, latissimus dorsi. Now we got a posterior view, all right? And let's get rid of a bunch of these muscles, like what? Oh, trapezius, deltoid just went away, some of these supraspinatus, infraspinatus. All right, triceps might go away, different heads of the triceps. So now we're left with this muscle right here. All right, so here's latissimus dorsi. And if we want to see the action, right, so here is extension. Boom, there's extension. All right, so here is extension, latissimus dorsi, posterior trunk. What's going to flex at the shoulder? Pectoralis major, because it's in the opposite body compartment. But, of course, when this muscle contracts, it will also do what? It will also adduct. Is that, adduct. Yeah, it will also adduct. And it can even medially rotate because the insertion is on the anterior part of the humerus. So if the anterior part of the humerus is pulled to midline, right, it can also cause medial rotation. If it was on the posterior part, it would cause lateral rotation, right? So opposite body compartments are really important. All right, so that's it for today's lecture. I might have the sign-in sheet down here. Do I have the sign-in sheet, or who has the sign-in sheet? You got it up there? Okay. So, oh, here it is. Yeah, here I got it. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And don't forget, next time, you need a pencil and, even more important, a good eraser, like one that's listed in your syllabus, right? And then it's going to be on bones. You might want to review that video on facial bones. Okay, so make sure you know your zygomatic from your sphenoid and your palatine by shape. Okay, all right.